This week on Crossing the Line, I'll speak to Jennifer Lowenstein, visiting research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University, about the tenuous ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the broader issues facing Palestinians. Then later in the podcast, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal and The War's Toll, compiled and read by Scott Bergwin of the Stand Independent News Service. All of this coming up. But first, a look back at the week's press in Palestine, reported by Kristen Ness.
From the Palestine News Network, I'm Kristen S. with This Week in Review for the 29th of December 2006 through the 4th of January 2007. This week, the new year came and went. Lists of the failures of 2006 were published. Few accomplishments were registered. Saddam Hussein was executed, turning Eid al-Adha from a holiday into a period of mourning. And by week's end, the internal Fatah-Hamas fighting was back in full swing in the Gaza Strip. In 2006, the Hamas party surprised everyone, even themselves, by not only becoming involved in the official political arena, but by sweeping the Legislative Council elections. The party began by attempting to overturn legislation quickly passed by the outgoing Fatah leadership, and several former council members were brought up on corruption charges. The United States then imposed an economic and political blockade on the government and people, publicly threatening any bank that engaged in transfers. Israeli forces at the international border crossings checked for money instead of weapons as funds for the Palestinians became the new danger. The Israeli government stopped paying the taxes it owed the Palestinians for the import-export fees as all international trade is controlled by the Israelis. That money was what the Palestinian government had used in the past to pay public sector employees. Salaries stopped being paid, and Israeli forces began arresting elected officials who ran on the Hamas ticket. The number of political prisoners in Israeli jails rose to 11,000, and the Palestinian resistance captured an Israeli soldier who was invading the southern Gaza Strip. The Israelis killed 742 Palestinians in 2006, most of them in the Gaza Strip, and arrested 5,671 Palestinians, most of them in the West Bank. The Palestinians killed 23 Israelis. The Israeli wall continued at record speed to confiscate West Bank land, and farmers were hit hard this year, both by being cut off from Jerusalem for market and by losing so much of their land. The entire northern section of Beit Lahem went to the Israelis by force. The list goes on, but in fact, despite the nonviolent resistance to land confiscation, settlement expansion, the wall, and to Israeli aerial bombardments in the northern Gaza Strip, 2006 was an abysmal year. The propaganda worked, and Hamas was blamed for the ills, and Fatah Hamas fighting began to pour into the streets, with tens of Palestinians killed by one another in the Gaza Strip. That also translated into kidnappings of foreigners this year, including a Peruvian working for the Agence France-Presse this week. PNN asked high-ranking Palestinian military officer Yusuf Issa if he told foreigners that they should leave the Gaza Strip this week due to security concerns. We did not call upon anyone to leave the Gaza Strip. This is all untrue. What we said is that the security situation in Gaza is difficult and foreigners should move cautiously. This is what we told them. Thank you, Yusuf Issa, for taking a minute to speak with PNN. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps. Two of the most major periods of killings were committed by Israeli forces in the northern Gaza Strip in July and November, and Israeli forces declared war on the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah, taking out its loss on the Palestinians. Prison conditions were described as the worst ever, and Marwan al-Barghouti, Hussein Khadr, and Speaker of the PLC, Dr. Aziz al-Dwaik, are still there. Negotiations for a prisoner release are ongoing. Hamas spokesperson Ismail Radwan addressed the progress of the prisoner exchange that should have several hundred of the 11,000 political prisoners currently in Israeli jails exchanged for the captured Israeli soldier. That number of 11,000 is new this year, released by the Palestinian Prisoner Society.
نحن من خلال وساطة الإخوة الأشقاء المصريين.
We from the mediation of the Egyptian brothers have announced that there is tangible progress with the prisoners exchange and the timing and also the number wanted for release. There is an acceptance for talks about the release of prisoners on the basis of criterion that we set. And there is also progress with getting women prisoners and Palestinian leaders and long-term sentence prisoners to be part of the exchange. But we did not reach final results because they may have backed down at the last moment from what had been agreed upon. Hamas spokesperson Ismail Radwan on the Palestinian political prisoner exchange that is still being negotiated. You're listening to the Palestine News Network. Palestinian Legislative Council member and former director of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, Bethlehem's own Asa Karaka, joined PNN this week to discuss this week's meeting between President Abbas and the Israeli Prime Minister Olmert, who made promises to remove several checkpoints inside the West Bank. But instead, restrictions increased, and a 16-year-old Dahesha refugee camp girl was beaten so badly in Abu Dis that she is hospitalized in Bethlehem's Hussein Hospital. Karaka also mentioned the progress of negotiations, which he described earlier in 2006 as cruel to the families and prisoners whose hopes ride on the conflicting reports. There was an agreement for the continuation of the Palestinian-Israeli meetings in the light of the last meeting. Several committees were formed for several issues because of the meeting. And with this, it is expected that there would be another meeting between President Abbas and Olmert in continuation of the preliminary meeting. I think that the meeting did not deal with the core issues as much as the technical issues, not more. So what was expected in the first meeting wasn't at the level that we wanted, especially in pushing the political process forward and Israel's withdrawal from the Palestinian areas and the release of Palestinian prisoners.
وانسحاب إسرائيل من المناطق الفلسطينية والإفراج عن المعتقلين الفلسطينيين.
Thank you, Asa Karaka, former director of the Palestinian Prisoner Society and current PLC member, who said this week that there is no point in forming committees if the Israeli attitude toward a prisoner exchange does not change. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps. There was literally almost no money this year due to the blockade and lack of salaries, and when the strike started, it seemed that there was no hope. Unity government formation talked about so much as the only hope to get the U.S. and its supporters to end the blockade continued to fail. Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Salah Rafat spoke to PNN about this week's intentions to restart unity government dialogue between Prime Minister Haniya and President Abbas, and the invitations from Cairo and Amman to host and oversee talks. However, President Abbas said this week that no talks about Palestinian unity would be held off of Palestinian soil. Salah Rafat has this.
We are always appreciative of the efforts of our brothers in the Arab countries to maintain the unity of the Palestinian powers. But from what I know, there are no calls for holding a meeting in Cairo, and all the efforts are for the continuation of the national dialogue in Gaza City, and it is supposed that after the holidays are over, the dialogue will resume. The brothers in Hamas asked to postpone the dialogue for several days because a number of their leaders went to the Hajj and have not yet returned. What we hope for is that the dialogue has positive results and forms a unity government that will be able to face Israeli policy and the Israeli siege, and a unity government that will be able to get this unjust siege lifted that has been forced on us from the American administration and Israel. Thank you, Palestine Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Salah Rafat. You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps.
This week, charities worked to distribute gifts to needy families for Eid al-Adha. Hamas opened an art exhibit and Palestinian farmers stopped bulldozers in the Bethlehem district. And this year, the Palestinian football movie made it to the Tehran Film Festival, but with Iran on the outs after the execution of Saddam Hussein, that seems a mixed blessing to some. The Open Bethlehem campaign brought some international clergy's attention to Bethlehem during this Christmas season, and the European Union, although they support the blockade of the Palestinian government, did donate funds to some of the people in need, as did Bahrain, Jordan, and several other neighbors. We enter 2007 in financial ruin, on the brink of civil war, and with unending Israeli theft of Palestinian land, livelihood, pride, and hope an undeniable fact in most sectors of society. Refugees were barely on the table this year, but Badil, the refugees' rights organization in Bethlehem, is launching a 2007 campaign to make it the year of refugees, both from 1967 and 1948. Eid al-Adha this week was marked only by the execution of Saddam Hussein, who was mourned throughout Palestinian cities, towns, and camps. He was declared a hero, while Iran and the U.S. client Shia government in Iraq took on the same status as the United States and Israel. Reporting from the Palestine News Network, I'm Kristen S. with This Week in Review for the 29th of December 2006 through the 4th of January 2007. For daily news and audio, see english.pnn.ps.
In Berkeley, I'm Christopher Brown, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On Friday, December 15th, gunmen opened fire on the convoy of Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh as he returned to Gaza. One of Haniyeh's bodyguards was killed, and Haniyeh's own son was one of five whom were injured in the attack. Hamas has accused Mohammed Dahlan of orchestrating the attack. Dahlan rejected Hamas's accusations of involvement, saying that Hamas, the governing party, was trying to, quote, mask its failures, unquote. For several days, fighting broke out between supporters of Hamas and Fatah in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, each side accusing the other of fomenting the violence, while here in the West, Middle East experts openly talked about civil war and fratricide. Presently, a tenuous ceasefire is in effect, while President Mahmoud Abbas meets with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and is attempting to hold early elections in Palestine. The economic situation in the territories continues to deteriorate. Unemployment in Gaza alone is 65%. Between 40 and 50% of the total Palestinian population are living below the international poverty line of $2 per day. In Gaza, 81% are living below the poverty line. Joining me to talk more about the ongoing situation in Gaza and the West Bank is Jennifer Lowenstein, visiting research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. Lowenstein spent the better part of 2 years in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, West Bank, and Lebanon. She is a member of the Palestine-Israel Peace and Justice Alliance, a founder of the Rafah Madison Sister Project, and currently working on a book about the transformation of the National Palestine Movement. She joins me on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Jennifer Lowenstein, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Jennifer, could you please talk about your recent visit to Gaza and what the current situation is right now?
Yeah, it's always a little difficult to know where to start because, of course, what's happening now is the result of many, many years of what's been going on. Sometimes the best starting point for recent events is the January 2006 PLC, Palestinian Legislative Council elections, mm-hmm. in which Hamas came to power. It's been since the emergence of the Hamas movement as the dominant political party, especially in the Gaza Strip, that the international siege or embargo on Gaza has been imposed. Even though it's called international, it is international, but it's primarily the result of U.S. policies, and the EU has gone along with them for the most part. So when I went to Gaza, what was really noticeable to me was how in just 2 years' time, the last time I'd been there was January 2004, was how in 2 years' time things had gotten so much worse. Gaza is already, for anyone who's been there, a desperate place. It's poor, it's overcrowded, it's probably about 80% refugee. The economy has long been destroyed, and it's hard to say that it's even worse But it is. It's even worse than it was. What little pockets of economic activity there were have been more or less snuffed out. And so people who've been there have been faced with a place that is just ramshackle, that is where buildings have been destroyed, where bullet holes can be seen in the facades of homes, where overcrowding is an understatement. It's the most densely populated strip of land on the planet. And here I was returning at the very end of October thinking it can't get worse, and it was noticeably worse. And one of the reasons for this is because for the past 10 months, civil servants have not received any salaries. And so as a result, for example, there are no garbage collection people. There are no sanitation workers. So there was rubbish strewn all over the streets. And in places, people had collected huge piles of garbage and were burning them in these big metal tins in the city center. It kind of had the look of a place after a big storm. In other words, you already have this desperately poor area with gray, tumble-down buildings, as I said, many of them destroyed, many of them pockmarked with bullets, laundry lines hanging up. It has the look of a very, very poor area, but this time it also looked as if it had just weathered a huge storm with trees and trash and every imaginable thing sort of scattering in the streets. The other thing that I thought was sort of that was noticeably different to me were the prevalence of donkey and horse-drawn carts. And that's because of the shortage of fuel that more and more people are resorting to these. They've always been present in the Gaza Strip, but this time was even more noticeable than before because, of course, fuel shortages are extreme now.
I was in the Gaza Strip 2003, literally the day after Rachel Corrie was killed. I went down there in support of the ISM workers who were grieving with their loss. And I remember, at least at the time, that it wasn't that difficult to get into Gaza. But subsequently, after that, especially in late 2003, definitely 2004 and last year as well as this year, it has become increasingly harder for just anyone to walk in. As you and I both know, the Karni crossing, which is the main crossing that leads in from Israel into Gaza, is continually closed, even to aid workers. How were you able to get in to Gaza this time?
Yeah, well, just let me correct you. You said that the Karni crossing is the main. That's the main industrial crossing.
My apologies.
The main human crossing is the Erez crossing, and that's okay. In the north of the Gaza Strip. But you're correct in saying that these have been shut down almost continuously now for the last year. And that's one of the reasons why the situation is so desperate, because food, medical aid, fuel, things that are necessities for basic living are not getting into the Strip, not on any regular basis. And you're also correct in saying that since 2003, it has become increasingly difficult for humans to get in, for outsiders to get into Gaza. And that, I think, is very, very significant, because what you can see is a gradual tightening or a human blockade into the Gaza Strip. Now, for the Gazans themselves, 1.4 million people, the Gaza Strip has been a prison for a long time, for at least 10 years. And this is because of the policy of closure. But since the Second Intifada in 2000, and in particular since probably about 2002, 2003, it has become increasingly difficult for anyone in Gaza to exit or enter without permission of the Israelis, of course. This is also true at the Rafah crossing, which, you know, a lot of people hailed that the Rafah crossing was now going to be in controlled by the Palestinian Authority. But in fact, it is still Israel that determines who exits and enters at the Rafah crossing on the border of Egypt. But you're talking also about, you're talking here about international visits. And again, first there was a policy where anyone entering Gaza after Rachel Corrie's death had to sign a paper absolving the Israeli Defense Forces, as they are wrongly called, of any responsibility if they were to die. Very sort of a sinister thing to sign. That's pretty much obsolete now, because nobody gets in except for international aid workers, diplomats, and journalists who are the full-time Middle East correspondents for well-known media outfits such as the New York Times, the BBC, etc. In other words, I got in 2004 as a freelance journalist after 5 days of haggling with the Beit Agron, the Israeli press house in West Jerusalem. They didn't want me to go in. They had to do extensive background checks. They wanted to make sure that the radio station I was working for was legitimate. And it was very extreme then. Now it's next to impossible for a freelancer or, say, a halftime journalist to get in. They have to be the full-time Middle East correspondent for, as I said, a reputable media outfit. So I can no longer get in as a freelancer. The way I managed to get in, first of all, Oxford University's Refugee Studies Center is considered an international organization because it has branch offices in other areas of the world. As such, I was able to work out, coordinate a sponsorship by the United Nations Special Coordinator's Office. And that is one of the only other ways that I know of for somebody to get in. I was legitimately there doing research. That was my purpose for going in this last trip. I conducted a lot of interviews with people, not only in the Hamas organization, but in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in Fatah, at the hospitals and various NGOs and that kind of thing. So, you know, my reasons for being there were completely legitimate, and I had to document these fairly extensively before getting in. It was interesting, however, that when I landed in Tel Aviv in June the first time, I was detained, searched, interrogated, and this lasted 6.5 hours. So everything, any person who the authorities know about ahead of time who is heading to Gaza is basically stopped and intimidated. So again, there are all kinds of blockades, psychological and physical, against people, outsiders, going into the Gaza Strip. And the reason is quite simple, in my view. That is because the Israelis do not want people, especially people who are going to be critical of what's happening there, going in and just reporting and seeing it. And I think very, very honestly that if a lot of people could get into Gaza, there would be a great deal of outrage because the conditions there are simply horrific. It's very hard to describe to people who have never seen real poverty or destruction on the scale that it exists in the Gaza Strip. It's hard to explain just how wretched the situation there has become, and that's one of the reasons people can't see it.
That is the voice of Jennifer Lowenstein, author and activist, and we are speaking to her from her home in Madison, Wisconsin. Jennifer, I wanted to ask you a question that I find very ironic. At the moment, President Mahmoud Abbas's forces are being trained in Jordan at the expense of the U.S.
and
government.
And in Jericho, yes.
And in Jericho. And as well as now, President Mahmoud Abbas is holding talks with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Mm-hmm. Now, I find it very ironic that these talks and these trainings are going on when not more than about a year ago, utterances were given to Fatah needs to be reined in. It's a terrorist organization. You know, Abbas cannot control his forces and all the rest of these things, essentially labeling him a terrorist. Isn't this just another classic case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend scenario now that we have Hamas in power and suddenly Fatah is on the back burner? They're now looking at Fatah being the more moderate.
It's actually much worse than what you're describing. Fatah has, you know, the Israelis use these particular parties according to how they serve their interests. Fatah has always been considered a much more moderate organization, and the Israelis have long known that they could easily work out a peace deal with Fatah if they wanted to. The point is that they don't want to. Now, and since 1994, since the establishment of the Palestinian Authority after the signing of the Oslo Accords, Fatah played a role that was very, I'm trying to think of the right word, suspect in the eyes of many Palestinians, because what they were essentially doing was acting as Israel's cop on the beat within the territories. In other words, their primary role was basically to police the territories so that Israelis could feel safe and secure, so that basically that they were stamping out any kind of resistance to the occupation. People realized this. They also saw increasing corruption and cronyism within Fatah that has long been a problem in the organization. And then since the onset of the Second Intifada in 2000, a complete sort of breakdown of Fatah as a unified central organization. Internally, Fatah was having problems of defining itself. Was it a political party? Was it a resistance organization? What were its goals? And what you saw during the 5 years of Intifada was a fracturing of Fatah into a number of different Fatahs, so that you had a Fatah in Nablus and a Fatah in Jenin and a Fatah in Ramallah. And all of these organizations were really starting to become decentralized. Arafat was losing control as the sole voice for Fatah. He was still pretty much a dictator, but, you know, he didn't have the authority that he once had. But to cut to the quick, the point is Fatah lost the elections last year because of how it was perceived by the people. People were very sick and tired of it. Hamas did not so much win as Fatah lost. Hamas has never commanded a majority of popular support. Even to this day, people voted for Hamas because it was seen as an alternative to what had become a completely corrupt organization, and that's very important. But you're asking now, here's the United States basically arming and training Abbas's security, preventive security forces, helping them. And Abbas, of course, is buying right into this. What's going to be the result of this? First of all, the U.S. is doing this for very significant reasons. Abbas is seen as malleable, as somebody and who commands an organization that can be controlled the same way that the quote-unquote moderate states of the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, are controlled and made pliant so that they serve United States interests. And this is very important. Hamas is not seen that way. Hamas is seen as an organization with increasing ties to the Syrian-Iranian Hezbollah axis. And in fact, that's true, although it's interesting because Hamas is a Sunni Muslim organization, and Hezbollah and the leadership of Syria and then Iran are Shiite organizations. But this kind of crystallization of power blocks of the sort of moderate Sunni Arab states and actors and then the Shiite states and Hamas is starting to deepen and strengthen in the Middle East. And this has very serious regional repercussions. It could have very serious repercussions. So here's the United States basically arming Abbas at the expense of Hamas. They are trying to stoke the fires of civil war. I think they're going to fail, but they're certainly causing a great deal of internal factionalism right now. And I think the most significant point in all of this from the perspective of Palestinian people is that Palestinians are not stupid, and they see that Fatah has become a tool of U.S. and, to some extent, Israeli national security interests. And that in itself is going to draw support away from it and probably strengthen Hamas and other organizations within the territories. And that's very significant.
Now, you're talking about drawing support away from Fatah, stronger support for Hamas. What are we to make of Abbas's calls for early elections in Palestine and, of course, the contentious debate that we're not even sure if this is a legal thing that he is allowed to do? And he's basically trying to do this more or less along the prodding that Israel and the U.S. are saying, well, you know, if you hold early elections and if you win, then suddenly you can start getting a lot of your aid back, you know. Suddenly
right.
The workers who have not been paid since March of this year can finally start being able to feed their families. Is this one of the chief reasons, do you think, that Abbas is looking to try to strengthen his hold on the Palestinian people is by calling early elections and saying, listen...
Oh, absolutely. This is very much part of the internal power struggle between Hamas and Fatah. Again, it's difficult to say that it's you know, the fault lines within Gaza, for example, are not that simple. There are a lot of people who still support Fatah, but who don't support Dahlan or Abbas.
Mm.
There are a lot of people who are fairly moderate. They're certainly not Islamist ideologues who are very disappointed in Hamas and very disappointed in Fatah. So you have, you know, the situation, it's fairly complex. But the fact is, the call for early elections, was it illegal? I couldn't tell you that from the standpoint of a lawyer. I don't know. It's certainly a way to try to break the power of Hamas, and they know it, and they're not about to step aside and say, sure, we'll hold early elections. If they were, however, there's no indication that Fatah would win. In fact, I would be surprised if Fatah won unless the elections were rigged, because I think so many people indeed see Fatah as more and more a tool of Western, of U.S. and Israeli security interests. The question is, and you alluded to this earlier, are people willing to vote for Fatah because they're desperate? In other words, you're correct. People haven't been paid for 10 months. There isn't enough food. There isn't enough. There aren't enough medical supplies. There isn't enough paper for school. I mean, there are fuel shortages. All of these things that we talked about earlier are very, very serious, and people are exhausted. So the question for us that remains, and I don't think there's an answer to this, is whether people are willing to accept the reemergence of Fatah as the ruling party because they are desperate, or whether they're going to oppose it and continue to support Hamas because they see that Fatah has fallen into the hands of the United States. I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I'm inclined to say that the latter is more likely, and that the long and short of all of this, after more months of fighting and tragic deaths and all kinds of things, is that there probably will be some kind of national unity government. But the fact is that will be unsatisfactory as well, and it's hard to predict what's going to happen in the future. I don't think anyone knows, but clearly things have come down to the wire, and there have to be some significant changes made over the next year, or you know, the whole society is breaking down.
Jennifer, recently, journalist Jonathan Cook, who's based in Nazareth, wrote something sarcastically in an article for the Electronic Intifada. I want to read a part of it and get your comment.
Sure.
Quote, Western politicians like to portray civil war as a consequence of the West's failure to intervene more effectively in the Middle East. If we were more engaged in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or more aggressive in opposing Syrian manipulations in Lebanon, or more hands-on in Iraq, the sectarian fighting could be prevented. The implication being, of course, that without the West's benevolent guidance, Arab societies are incapable of dragging themselves out of their primal state of barbarity. Jennifer, what's your comment on this quote?
Well, I'm a big fan of Jonathan Cook's, and I think he's very perceptive. However, I disagree with him on one point, but let me back up. He's absolutely right. We have very entrenched racist notions about not only Arab societies, but societies in Africa and Asia and in South America as well, that, you know, somehow we have a civilizing mission to bring freedom and democracy to them and to show them the correct path of government and all kinds of things. Of course, the irony of that is that we, you know, insisted on democratic elections in Palestine, and they got democratic elections and carried them out very well all on their own and elected Hamas to power, and that wasn't what the United States wanted. So, of course, we're seeing what's going on now. What I disagree with Cook on, and we've spoken about this very directly, is that I do not think that Palestine is going to erupt into civil war. The conditions for civil war, religious divisions, socioeconomic divisions, geography, fighting over land, don't exist in Palestine. You have 99%, well, probably 95% Sunni Muslims and some Christians who are basically united. There are no land disputes among the Palestinians. There aren't any, you know, ethnic divisions that divide Palestinians. They're all of the same ethnicity. You will see factional fighting increase and abate, you know, go back and forth. And I think that's clear.
Hmm.
I think the West is very deliberately trying to make that a serious problem. And, of course, they're succeeding. And I don't want to just blame it on the West. It's the Palestinians are succeeding in worsening the factional rifts. But the fact is, there are no conditions. There are no real sociological conditions for Palestine to erupt into civil war. And the Palestinians themselves know better. They know that that's what the Israelis would like. They know that's what the Americans would like to see, because, of course, it's a perfect pretext to send in the IDF, to send in more American support, and to clamp down on any real indigenous resistance against occupation and against the sort of imperial drives that are behind U.S. policies.
Finally, Jennifer Lowenstein, what are your thoughts about the future of the West Bank and Gaza? Where is it headed?
Oh, that's a terrible question to end on, because I feel so cynical, and I don't want to end this interview on a real negative note. I think things are getting worse, and I think that they will continue to get worse in the short run. I'm speaking probably within the next 5 years or so. I think it's a very desperate and dire situation for Palestinians. But I have to say also that there are very real reasons to be optimistic. One of those reasons, I think, first of all, Palestinians and people allied to them are not going to give up. There's no chance that resistance to what Israel has been doing and what the United States has been backing, there's no chance that that's going to be wiped out, not unless, you know, there's some kind of nuclear apocalypse. But locally within Wisconsin, across the United States, I think that there is a perceptible shift in among the grassroots, among the people in this country who are getting slowly more enlightened about what the United States is doing in the Middle East, a little more cynical about what Israel represents. I think something like Jimmy Carter's book is a very positive sign, not because of how it has been treated in the political level in our country, but how it's been welcomed on the popular level. I think that's a sign that people are ready and waiting for this kind of thing, that there's a real, you know, we've gotten to a point where there is greater acceptance of criticism of Israel, again, on a popular level. That has not penetrated the political levels yet, as far as I can tell. It's still taboo to say anything critical of Israel within the Congress or even within local governments here. But eventually that's going to crumble, too. That will not continue. So there are real reasons for hope. And, you know, you have this Iraq study group basically say that every person that they spoke to in the Middle East, every head of state, every politician, every diplomat has said that the core of the problems in the Middle East centers on Palestine, and we have to confront the Palestine issue before there's going to be any real progress on anything else. And I think that when you have a study group coming out and saying this, you know, it can only be ignored for so long before it's going to hit people that, you know, terror attacks in the United States are going to happen again. We should be prepared for them, because until the U.S. changes its policies in the Middle East, until it ceases to support Israel, which has violated international law repeatedly for the last 60-some years, things are only going to get worse. And I think people are starting to recognize that we have to change course there. So there are some reasons for hope. I probably sound a little bit skeptical. I am skeptical, but at the same time, I'm not giving up hope, and I don't think there's any reason to give up hope, especially not when you believe in something as strongly as I do about this particular cause.
We've been speaking to Jennifer Lowenstein, writer, activist, and visiting research fellow at Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you very much again for having me.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist who chronicles the human condition. He has been a resident of Pennsylvania's death row for 23 years. Writing from his solitary confinement cell, his essays have reached a worldwide audience. His books, Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, All Things Censored, Faith of Our Fathers, and the recently released We Want Freedom, have sold over 150,000 copies and have been translated into 7 languages. His 1982 murder trial and subsequent conviction have been the subject of great debate.
The urge to surge. Within days, the Bush regime is expected to announce its so-called new strategy in Iraq, the most talked-about plan being a surge in U.S. forces in Iraq. By surge is meant the significant increase in troop size in that beleaguered country, a plan meant to address the obvious failures in Iraq. In light of this rumored surge, one wonders, what does it take for the administration to listen to the voices of the people? In February and March 2003, the U.S. and much of the world spoke, with millions marching in cities all across the globe against the scourge of war. The Bush regime ignored them. No, ignored isn't right. President Bush belittled the protests as a focus group. A focus group? Only to this mad president could the largest demonstrations in U.S. history constitute a focus group. Within days, we shall hear what the decider has decided. You can bet that it will conflict with the will of most American citizens. For if it conflicts his own misbegotten vision, he will reject it utterly. Demonstrations don't matter. Elections don't matter. No matter what most Americans think, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters but what the decider decides. There's a word for that, and it sure ain't democracy. Americans have settled for a dictatorship of one. In fact, a dictatorship of disaster. Like good little sheep, they plan to silently acquiesce as more of their young people are slain on an altar slick with oil. There's a word for that. It's called madness. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The War's Toll. For the 7 days through January 2, 2007. I'll be reading the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers reported killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also the names of some Iraqi civilians. These civilians were reported killed on March 25, 2003, just 6 days into the invasion. But first, the numbers. As of this morning, January 3, 2007, 3,254 coalition soldiers have been reported killed in Iraq. Of that number, 3,004 are U.S. soldiers. The Department of Defense reports that 22,565 U.S. soldiers have been wounded in Iraq. They also report that 46,880 have suffered what are called non-mortal casualties. These numbers come from iCasualties.org. Also, 377 private contractors have been reported killed in Iraq. In the past 7 days, then, 25 U.S. and coalition soldiers are reported killed in Iraq. In Afghanistan, 516 coalition soldiers have been killed since the invasion, October 2001. Of that number, 357 are U.S. soldiers. Also, the Department of Defense reports that 1,062 U.S. soldiers have been wounded. 5,994 have suffered non-mortal wounds. In the past week, one coalition soldier was reported killed. We still have no numbers for casualties, at least wounded soldiers of other nationalities. Also in Afghanistan, in the past week, 18 Afghanis were reported killed. The total for December 2006 was at least 270 Afghanis killed. And the total for the 9 months that we calculated the Afghani casualties is at least 4,319 Afghanis killed. These numbers also come from iCasualties.org. Back to Iraq. According to IraqBodyCount.org, the total of Iraqi civilian deaths since the invasion is at 58,056. We'll also continue to remind listeners that the John Hopkins study in the Lancet Journal, published now several weeks ago, put the Iraqi civilian death total at near 655,000. That would put the casualties or wounded Iraqis in the war in the hundreds of thousands, if not over a million. In the past week, at least 371 Iraqis were killed, bringing the total in December of 2006 to 1,752, and the total so far in January of 2007 at 101. The total for 2006 is estimated from this information derived from Iraq Body Count and iCasualties.org at 26,892 Iraqi civilian deaths. The financial cost of the war is at $355.2 billion and counting. This is just for the Iraq War. Taxpayers in Michigan, your tax bill to date is $9.5 billion and counting. This information is from costofwar.com. I will now read the names of Iraqi civilians. The civilians again were reported killed on the 25th of March, 2003. Nazila Muhammad, 58-year-old woman. Nedhal Abed, 26-year-old woman. Negem Dham Afrin, 47-year-old man. Noura Fatah Ismail, 5-year-old boy. Noris Abed Kathem Ank, 25-year-old man. Ofea Adan Gaber Alzagawe, 58-year-old woman. Ramlach Rashid Ahmad, 9-year-old girl. Reath Gabar Sibake, 1-year-old boy. Mohem Tafek Sirhan Aliode, 14-year-old boy. Saad Hade Abbas Altameme, 19-year-old man. I will now read the names of coalition soldiers killed in Afghanistan, reported killed in Afghanistan in the past week. On the 27th of December, 2006, James Dwyer, 29 years old, British Army, no hometown given, South Africa. I will now read the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers reported killed in Iraq in the past 7 days. On the 23rd of December, Elias Elias, 27 years old, U.S. Army, Glendora, California. Also on the 23rd of December, Bobby Mejia II, 20 years old, U.S. Army, Saginaw, Michigan. And also on the 23rd of December, Michael J. Crutchfield, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Stockton, California. On the 24th of December, Stephen L. Morris, 21 years old, U.S. Marine, Lake Jackson, Texas. On the 25th of December, Andrew H. Nelson, 19 years old, U.S. Army, St. John's, Michigan. Also on the 25th of December, Aaron L. Preston, 29 years old, U.S. Army, Dallas, Texas. On the 26th of December, John T. Bubick, 25 years old, U.S. Army, Collegeville, Pennsylvania. Back to the 25th of December, J.S. Moon, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Levittown, Pennsylvania. Also on the 25th of December, Dexter E. Willis, 37 years old, U.S. Army, Winder, Georgia. And also on the 25th of December, Hayes Clayton, 29 years old, U.S. Army, no hometown given, Georgia. On the 26th of December, Joshua M. Schmitz, 21 years old, U.S. Marine, Spencer, Wisconsin. Also on the 26th of December, Joseph A. Strong, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Lebanon, Indiana. On the 27th of December, Douglas L. Tinsley, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Chester, South Carolina. Also on the 27th of December, two soldiers from Latvia, whose names I wish not to try to pronounce, as I do not want to do a disservice to their memory. but one 24-year-old and one 25-year-old from the Latvian army on December 27, 2006. Also on the 27th of December, William C. Koprinz, Jr., 24 years old, U.S. Army, Lenoir City, Tennessee. Also on the 27th of December, Nathaniel A. Given, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Dickinson, Texas. Also on the 27th of December, Christopher P. Messer, 28 years old, U.S. Army, St. Petersburg, Florida. Also on the 27th of December, Clinton T. McCormick, 20 years old, U.S. Army, Jacksonville, Florida. And also on the 27th of December, Edward W. Schaefer, 24 years old, U.S. Army, Mont Alto, Pennsylvania. On the 28th of December, Graham Hesketh, 35 years old, British Army, Liverpool, England. Also on the 28th of December, William D. Spencer, 20 years old, U.S. Marine Reserve, Paris, Tennessee. Also on the 28th of December, Nicholas A. Miller, 20 years old, U.S. Marine Reserve, Silverwood, Michigan. Also on the 28th of December, Dustin R. Donica, 22 years old, U.S. Army, Spring, Texas. And also on the 28th of December, Christopher E. Eccleson, 22 years old, U.S. Marine Reserve, Vassar, Michigan. On the 29th of December, William R. Newgard, 20 years old, U.S. Army, Arlington Heights, Illinois. Also on the 29th of December, Lawrence J. Carter, 25 years old, U.S. Army, Rancho Cucamonga, California. On the 31st of December, Rich Smith, 20 years old, U.S. Army, no hometown given, Texas. This has been The War's Toll for the 7 days through the 2nd of January 2007. I'm Scott Berguin from the Stand Independent News Service. As always, our hearts go out to the fallen, their loved ones, their relatives, their neighbors, in all countries.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios at 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Kristen S., contributing writer Scott Bergwin, and Mumia Abu-Jamal for their invaluable contributions to this program. In Berkeley, this is Christopher Brown for Crossing the Line. Signing off.